For the week of May 1st, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 320, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy May Day, Sperling.
Happy birthday, Michael.
Thank you very much. I have to say, it's a little overwhelming. I mean, all our fans, my God, the phone calls, the letters, the Skypes, the birthday cards, the gifts, the flowers, the candy, the PayPal payments they're sending me. People, it's too much. I mean, seeing all the stuff I'm getting, I can't even imagine what Sperling must get on his birthday. So really, it's, you know, thank you so much. It really means a lot that so many thousands of you reached out to me on my birthday. I appreciate it a lot. Sperling, you know what I'm talking about, obviously.
No, I don't get anything from our listeners on other than love, of course, but I don't even think our listeners know when my birthday is, because of course I turn 21 again every single year. So maybe they feel like they've already given me a present for that year.
Our present to them this year is, of course, another podcast. And what will we talk about this week?
Well, on this week's show, we'll talk about how Comcast is the new Disney. At the very least, the cable giant turned media conglomerate is doing its best to emulate their successful studio rival, and last week, they took another step toward that goal by acquiring DreamWorks Animation for a paltry $3.8 billion.
And that's all they need is a podcast, and everything will be perfect.
Exactly. We should just head up right on over there. I hear they have a great amusement park in their waiting room. Meg James, a corporate media reporter for the Los Angeles Times, she's going to be joining us later in the program to tell us all about it. We'll also take a look at what is being referred to as the Hamilton effect on Broadway. Apparently, this condition presents itself during Tony Awards season when you open a musical that blends hip-hop and history in a way that makes the show a cultural phenomenon and the inevitable winner of this year's much-coveted Best Musical Tony. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz.
And birthday boy.
And birthday boy, that's right. Michael Giltz, you're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We get our information from RentTrack. You'll find a link in our show notes. We pull info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, and Mojo, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is The Avengers. I mean, Captain America, Civil War. It is, for all intents and purposes, a new Avengers film. It grossed $200 million overseas over the weekend. It's in 37 territories. It hasn't opened up in North America or even China yet, but it's a big monster hit.
You know, when I saw the film, I actually thought the same thing. I thought, wait, why is this called Captain America? It should be called The Avengers.
Well, it's, you know, there's reasons for it, right? It focuses on Cap and his friendship with his old buddy, and there's internecine fighting in the Avenger people. But, you know, it's all one big story, frankly. That's what it becomes, isn't it?
Yes.
They're all appearing in each other's movies and all that. Now, at your premiere, did you see it in 2D or 3D or IMAX? What was the deal?
I saw it in 2D on a big giant screen at CinemaCon, and it's a good movie. I mean, people should go
see it. Oh, they
showed
the whole movie there?
Oh, yeah. No, it was good.
Oh,
again, it's the second movie this year where you have superhero versus superhero fighting one another. But, you know, it was good. This one was the good movie.
How did it compare to the other Avenger movies? Was it better than them? Was it as, you know, I mean, I thought the last Captain America was pretty good, and I thought it was the best of the whole bunch of this, you know, world.
Well, I think that
it had a nice 70s vibe and was, you know, pretty good.
I think you'll find it very comparable.
Okay.
I mean, it's definitely a strong film.
All right.
And a lot more character-driven than you would imagine.
Would it be on your list of the best films of the year?
I don't think any superhero film except for maybe The Dark Knight, has ever been on my list of top 10 films of the year.
Oh, not Superman the movie? Not the Spider-Man 1 or 2 with Tobey Maguire?
Okay, Spider-Man 1 would have been, yes. But, that happened so long ago when I was 21 that I can't remember it.
Well, Captain America: Civil War is off to a huge start. It cost about $250 million to make. Maybe. We don't really know. The last Captain America, I think, cost $175. And this movie's budget actually was led to a big battle at Marvel, didn't it? Over who would be in control of Marvel and their movies. But it is a big budget because it launches two new superheroes, Black Panther and the new Spider-Man, Tom Holland.
I'm not going to say anything.
Well, did you like that?
Spoiler
those
alert,
two characters?
I did like those two characters.
All right, there you go. Job well done.
Yes.
It's part of the big next story arc for the Marvel Universe. It's essentially an Avengers film. And so it needed a big budget. That was the argument by Kevin Feige. How do you say his name?
Feige?
Feige, okay. And he and Ike Perlmutter were fighting Ike is sort of the Marvel big wig, and Ike is sort of tough on budgets, and Kevin was saying, no, it needs to be big, and Kevin won that battle. He now reports directly to Alan Horn and got the big budget he thought the movie needed. We don't know exactly how much that is, but, you know, it'll make more than Batman versus Superman, but still, it's a very expensive movie just like that one. So if it makes $1 billion, it's just $100 million more, they'll say, what a huge, great hit. Whereas Batman versus Superman made $800, $900 million and say, flop.
Well, think about it. If Batman v Superman can make nearly $1 billion and be a bad movie, imagine what a good movie could make.
Well, we're about to find out.
I guess so.
And of course, it launches the next stage of the universe. We've got one more movie this year, Doctor Strange, and three movies in 2017, all part of the Marvel world, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, the Spider-Man solo movie with Tom Holland, who will be 21 when that movie comes out, and Thor Ragnarok in November of 2017, then three more in 2018. So they just keep on coming. And every single one of them is a sure bet, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're going to make $1 trillion, $1 million. Absolutely.
They're all sure bets until something starts to flop.
Exactly. Now, this is, you know, what you get when you base your product around IP, intellectual property. You basically say, okay, well, it's not just a movie. It's the concept of the superheroes, and we're going to do theme parks and movies and books and television shows and you name it. And that's what they're doing. That's what Disney is very, very good at and has become very good at under Robert Iger.
All right, well, that is the number one movie in the world. And the number two movie around the world is The Jungle Book, another $100 million. It's just under $700 million worldwide. And it, too, could hit $1 billion before all is said and done. It is on fire in North America and pretty much everywhere. It's getting great legs. People love it. It's doing really, really well.
I mean, everybody that sees this movie comes out of it saying, you've got to go see it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, again, like you say, The Jungle Book beefs up the Jungle Book ride at Disney World. It lets you add in new attractions or new characters to theme parks. It lets you maybe do a TV spinoff with Baloo. I mean, the possibilities are endless.
Yes. Good point. And, you know, if you're Disney, you're just having a great year, as we'll see as you go down this list.
Right. They've solved the puzzle, right? They're going to always have big hits forever. That's what they think.
That always happens.
They've got Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars. And between those three and their other movies, and redoing fairy tales and the theme park, they can't ever miss.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you're being sarcastic.
Even God could sink the Titanic. So, I mean, you know, they're on fire. They're doing great.
Yes, they are.
You know, but these things have cycles. And then someday, two or three big, big movies are going to collapse really quickly in a row. And it's going to sort of take people's breath away.
Yeah, just ask Apple. Just ask Universal. It happens.
At number three around the world is a big Chinese hit. It's called Finding Mr. Right 2, sort of. It might also be called Book of Love. It's a little confusing for me. But this is a romantic drama. It is directed by the female director Shui Zilu, and it's her third big hit in a row. It's also a big hit for the female lead, who's had a couple flops in a row, so it's a good comeback for her. It grossed $51 million over the weekend. I was a little confused about what this movie was about, because they called it Finding Mr. Right 2. And looking at the original, I thought, how could there be a sequel to this? Turns out it's not really a sequel. It's just a new movie with the same lead actors and the same director making another romantic drama. They just gave it the same name so it would help sell it. But $51 million, that's a big opening weekend. It's a big success story for the female director. I call her female director because I want to tout how, you know, unusual and great that is. So, you know, she's like the Penny Marshall of China. So it's a good success story all around.
I wonder if she'd actually consider that a compliment.
Why not?
I don't know. But, you know, I am really impressed at the way that you pronounced her name.
Oh, well, I looked it up. Okay. And number four is Huntsman Winter's War, another $16 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide. It cost $115 million to make. This will not end well. And number five is Zootopia, $13 million over the weekend, $930 million worldwide. Will it get to $1 billion? It's not going to be easy. And it's already, of course, a huge success. And it only cost maybe $175 million to make.
Only, you know, just a pittance, practically.
That's how Disney's doing really well, right?
Yes.
I mean, they've got these big name properties, but this movie, which was a real gamble, bold, different, no, you know, the idea of making any movie that's not based on something that already exists is not that bold, but this was a big bet, and it paid off in spades.
Well, think about it. If they can get Captain America up to $1 billion and they can get Jungle Book up to $1 billion, it looks like Zootopia will hit. I don't know. Maybe
gonna,
not.
It's going to be tough.
Yeah, but they will have three nearly $1 billion movies in 1 year.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I mean, that's pretty
remarkable. They've got Star Wars and Christmas.
Good point. They might have four.
At number six is Mother's Day. Speaking of Penny Marshall, her dad, right? Gary Marshall.
Yeah.
The latest film in his holiday franchise, I guess that's what we call it. It made $10 million over the weekend. It opened a little bit in 21 territory, so it's not just North America. A poor opening, dreadful reviews. People were offended by this movie. Julia Roberts has a minor role, and they had stories about how she made $3 million for 4 days' work. Oh, the scandal. But if you look at the first two movies, the second one didn't make nearly as much as the first, but it also cost half as much. The first movie, Valentine's Day, I think it was, cost $52 million to make. It had a ton of stars. The second one didn't have quite as many, and it only cost $26 million to make. The third one, we don't know the budget, but I'm guessing it's about $25 million. And those first two made $100 million overseas. If this one can make $100 million overseas, it doesn't matter what it makes in North America. So, you know, this is not this result they wanted, but they're not going to lose any money, that's for sure.
Well, and I take it back. I was doing some math, and I thought, wait, Penny Marshall could never be Gary Marshall's daughter. They're brother, sister, they're siblings.
Oh, golly, that's right. I'm a dick. Sorry about that, Penny. Sorry, Gary. That's because I see her as eternally young.
Oh, yeah, nice recovery.
At number seven is Keanu. This is the Key and Peele film. Sort of a spoof on John Wick, the Keanu Reeves movie, sort of. Very funny trailer with a cute little cat. And I have to say, I was wrong.
Wait, can I? I'm going to kind of like
isolate
that, and I'm just going to turn it into one of those, you know, morning zoo button things where it just, nobody, I was wrong.
Nobody
I was
even
wrong.
Knew it, and I was wrong. Because if when I was looking at the tracking for this movie and what they're like, I don't know, about $10 million. I thought they always get wrong films that appeal to black audiences. Key and Peele, of course, appeal to everyone. But, you know, you have a loyal fan base among the black community for these guys. They're great. They're very talented. A lot of people love them. And I thought, they're way underestimating this movie. That's crazy. They're wrong. It went in even lower than the tracking. So this did not do well. I don't know why. I don't know why it didn't pop a little bit. The reviews were not great, but it was a funny trailer. And it's Key and Peele. You know, you would say, well, they've got all this big fan base on TV. And when it doesn't work, you say, you got all those videos on YouTube. They can watch them for free. Why should they pay? You know, so you just never know. But I am a little surprised that this did not outperform the tracking. In fact, it did less well than the tracking. So that doesn't bode well for the legs of this movie.
Well, and I wonder, you know, did social media have anything to do with it? Because it got mixed reviews and mixed word of mouth. So I wonder if maybe Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you know, the audience tapered off.
I'm sure it did. So, you know, clearly not good word of mouth when it doesn't even meet its tracking. And we thought the tracking was probably on the conservative side.
Yeah.
And number eight is another Chinese hit film, more modest than Finding Mr. Right 2. This is MBA Partners. It seems to be a romantic drama about three young women with dreams of making it in the world of business. The trailer confused me when I watched it online, but that's how it was described somewhere. It made $7.5 million over the weekend and has lots of young female stars.
You know, it may have also confused you, the trailer, that is, by being in a different language other than English.
Yes. When I looked at the visual, I thought, this isn't exactly what I thought it was from the written description I found. But that's what we do when we try to piece together what's going on.
Yeah.
Like Phantom of the Theater. This is our number nine film of the week. It's a Chinese Hong Kong sort of suspense horror film with a romantic element. It's set in Shanghai in the 1930s. It's about a theater troupe that was killed in a terrible fire, and now they haunt the theater. And a couple falling in love needs to worry about that. It grossed $7 million over the weekend. So these numbers, we don't know what the budgets of the movies are. We know you can make a lot more money than that in China. Just look at Finding Mr. Right 2. But as far as what they cost and what they'll make, we have no idea whether these are hits or misses. If you know more about these movies, or if you know the plot of MBA Partners, what should you do?
You should write to us. And you can do that by writing to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also go to our Facebook page and leave us a message there. We always respond. It's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Or you can follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle.
That's right. At number 10 is Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. The hit, the flop, the whatever you want to call it. $862 million worldwide. It may not even get to $900 million. It's certainly a commercial success. It certainly did far better than Man of Steel. So, you know, this has increased the box office for these movies. Like Man of Steel, it did not get great reviews, but more people paid to see it. Suicide Squad looks very funny. That's the next movie in the DC universe. I like that trailer a lot. So we'll have to see where they end up. But Certainly, they're making money.
I like to call Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice the $850 million flop.
It's not, though, commercially.
I know that.
What matters is what it cost and what it made. Has it set up the universe? Well, it did better than Man of Steel.
Well, and I'm wondering, and I know you're wondering, how Purple Rain, a movie from, what was it, 1984, 85, somewhere in there?
Yes.
I'm wondering how that did over the weekend, but we'll never know, at least not today, how this movie did. It was put back into theaters by AMC Cinemas here in the United States. Of course, it stars Prince, who passed away a week ago. And they put it in really quickly last week in 87 locations. And then they said, hey, this went great. Let's expand it to 200 theaters.
And it's not on the charts. There are movies on one screen that gross $300 at like Film Forum. And that's on Box Office Mojo's chart. But Purple Rain's not on there because it's only in one theater and they can choose not to report it. Is that how it works?
You know, I have no idea. I am curious about that because
I wouldn't think you could keep it secret. I thought it was all too automated at this stage.
It pretty much is. I mean, it's pretty much going to
Rent Track. Where's Purple Rain?
Yeah, I would imagine that Warner Brothers, which released that film to AMC, I think they may have asked Rent Track not to report those figures.
But why? Especially if it did well and they wanted to show it on more screens the following weekend.
I don't know. Maybe because they're screening it at 1985 prices and they think, oh, well, this will look like it didn't make any money. Given, you know, what some of these big billion-dollar movies are making.
No, that's stupid.
All right.
I mean, but again, how do they have the ability to do that? How can they just say, I don't tell the people what we made?
Well,
I
very easily.
You could just squash information about a movie. I thought there was oversight and third parties, and the information was automated. And sorry, your movie didn't do well. You don't get to decide. We don't get to see the numbers.
Well,
that's what concerns me. How they can randomly just say, obviously, if it was a new movie, not a re-release of a movie no one expected to make money, there'd be a big outcry. If your new movie opens and it doesn't make any money, if Tom Hanks said, you know what, a hologram for the king, this movie has not done well. This may be his lowest grossing movie in 25 years. I mean, this is really not doing well. I'm a little surprised.
I didn't even know
trailer.
This movie was released, to be honest with you.
Huh?
That should tell you something. I had no idea it was released.
Oh, yeah. No, it's out in theaters. It's the second or third weekend. It's going to be his lowest grossing movie since The Bonfire of the Vanities in 1990, which was a huge flop. That only made $15 million. It may gross less than The Man with One Red Shoe from back in 1985 when he was barely a star yet. He wasn't a star yet. So that movie made $8 million. So this film starring Tom Hanks is really a low grosser. Can his distributor just say, hey, don't report the numbers?
Well, remember who pays Rent Track. It's the studios. So
yeah, but individually, I wouldn't think as a group they would cotton to somebody individually saying, ah, never mind, ignore those.
I don't know. I mean, yeah. It does actually make me wonder how they were able to prevent that from being reported.
I assume it's one theater and that helps.
Yes, that does help because that one theater could actually not report those grosses.
And we reported that Deadpool was coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, and we use that as an example to talk about how Hollywood is maximizing the money from movies, how this whole idea of the screening room where you have to show movies day and date in the home, otherwise you're losing out on all those people who don't go to the movies. We say, well, we're reaching them. It's just not that day and date. It happens to be 8 or 10 or 12 weeks later. For example, Deadpool is coming out and is out now on digital download. We said it would. They hadn't announced a date yet, but suddenly on April 26th, it became available. That means the weekend before it hit digital download, it was the number 14 movie in the country. It had grossed like $700,000. The week before, it grossed $1 million, and the week before that, $2 million. It was playing on 600 screens. In other words, this movie played perfectly. It's like a relay race where you're passing the baton from one person to the other. It opened on February 12th, made tons of money unexpectedly. 11 weeks after its opening, just as it's fading at the box office and about to leave, the baton gets passed and it's available on digital download.
What I would say is, you know what, and I understand why they wanted to do it now. I would have said, give it one more week, just one more week, 12 weeks. You would have had your three-month window and you would have made another $700,000 at the box office. And
I think theater owners are hugging you right now.
I'm sure they are.
Giving you big hugs. So that's 11 weeks after its opening, it goes digital. 10 days after that, it's available on DVD and Blu-ray. That's May 10th. What's the next step in the chain? Is it pay-per-view, streaming? Is it premium cable? What's the next step?
Well, no, home video.
No, we already said that. May 10th, it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray.
Okay.
What's
sorry.
The next step after that?
Yeah, then it would be premium cable.
So HBO type deal.
Correct. Pay-per-view is kind of, probably around the same time. Pay-per-view around the same time.
So just as digital download and DVD and Blu-ray happen around the same time, premium cable channels and pay-per-view, that's, you know, video on demand, right?
Yeah. So actually, I would say it's pay-per-view, then premium cable, then basic cable. Streaming services fit somewhere in there.
All right. And then network TV. And of course, all this happens not
there,
just
there
in
is
North
no
America.
More network TV. Let's face it. I mean,
oh, they don't show movies anymore, do
no,
they?
No, exactly.
They really don't, do they?
No. It used to be that, you know, on a Sunday night, rather than do programming.
The Saturday night movie or Sunday
night
movie.
They don't do it anymore.
It's just no point because it's so far after that. But that goes, basic cable is where that happens now.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So TBS and people like that.
Now, speaking of no point, okay, you know what there is really no point in doing this year? What? If you're a Broadway producer, okay, there is no point if you have a musical being, you know, that's opening this year to try and mount a Best Musical Tony Award campaign.
Wrong. Well, you know why?
Yes,
because
I do.
Promoting your show. It's not just about winning the Tony for Best Musical. It's saying, hey, I'm up for 7 awards. I'm up for 9 awards. We haven't had the Tony nominations yet.
They're tomorrow. We will tomorrow.
They will. And the LA Times wrote a story saying, hey, look at the Hamilton. This is the 800. Why does this gorilla keep showing up?
I don't know, but he's 800 pounds.
Why
does he
go on a diet? Good Lord. I've been talking to you for too long. Oh, man. I need a break.
Hey, great minds think alike.
Yeah. So the Tony nominations come out tomorrow. Hamilton, of course, will dominate. There will be other shows playing because it's not a lock for Best Actor. It's not a lock for Best Actress. A lot of the tech awards, it probably is, though I imagine set design and some others, there's probably a little opening. It will win Best Musical. It will win Best Score. No question about that. Will it win Best Book? Probably that too. So yeah, it's a big, massive hit. And they're trying to spin this somehow into a problem.
Well, I don't want to
say, right?
Well,
they're saying,
know.
Oh, what a nightmare. No, a big hit on Broadway. Everybody loves it. There's nobody on Broadway bad-mouthing the Hamilton.
Some question about finding empirical evidence that because everybody's headed to Broadway to see Hamilton in hopes of seeing Hamilton, that, you know, the box office would go up at other venues around town that are showing, musicals and theater. And they haven't seen that necessarily.
No way to track such a bizarre supposition. Oh, there will be this. How would you?
You know, basically what I was trying to say in a very long-winded way is a rising tide lifts all boats. They haven't seen that. And their evidence here.
But of course they have. Broadway's doing great. And when there are good hits and people see a good hit, they get the habit and they want to go see another show. You see it at the movies, and I'm sure you see it at Broadway. You can't track that.
Well, they track it year over year.
All you can say is, hey, look, the box office is doing great. Ticket sales are up over last year. Broadway's in good shape. We got another big hit, long-running hit, and everybody's happy.
Well, here's from the article written by Steve Zeitchik in the LA Times. The number of Broadway tickets sold in the month of April, for instance, has been down 3 of the 4 weeks compared with 2015, in one case by nearly 8%. You know, again,
It's been a bad spring and there haven't been a lot of good new shows.
Well,
they wish they had another Hamilton. You know what? You've had Bright Star and Waitress. Waitress is doing all right, is doing well, actually. Bright Star and Tuck Everlasting and a couple other shows that just aren't that good and they're not going to last for long.
Yeah, it's very hard to compare year over year when you have a huge hit like Hamilton because people steer clear of it. You know, they might say, hey, I'm going to open up in the fall.
But they didn't.
Well, not those shows.
You know, those plans are made long in advance. So
no,
it's very
true.
Hard to maneuver your show and stay in and stay out. Something Rotten did that last year. It said, let's just get into the Tony Awards season and get in before Hamilton shows up. So, you know, sometimes you can speed it up. But these are big ships. You can't make those sort of last minute adjustments. Shuffle Along is probably wishing they waited till the fall of 2016. So they'd be in the next year's award season. But they didn't. They're here. They're a big show. They're going to be up for Best New Musical. They were hoping to get considered Best Revival, but that didn't happen.
Right, and it is again, a new musical, okay? It's pretty much
not necessarily.
Well,
I mean,
okay.
It's a brand new book, but a lot of shows have brand new books
with
and
older
pre-existing
songs. Yeah, okay.
In this case, though, I think it was the right call. It was a call, though. I mean, it was worth considering. I mean, I think it's pretty clear it's a new musical because it's an entirely new book. It's not like they spruced up the book or made it whatever, you know. Well, if you take old Gershwin songs and create a new show, yeah, okay, your music isn't eligible, but it's still a new show. So yeah, Shuffle Along was trying to pull a fast one a little bit. Not that it would have necessarily won Best Revival either. because that's the strongest category going.
Well, and I think a lot of people might, there's 860 Tony voters, and I think a lot of them would have said, you know what, we don't like the way they kind of like...
Well, that would have hurt them too. Yeah. Yeah. But again, this is not anything new. Trying to position yourself for the best category happens all the time in all the awards seasons. And it certainly happens in the acting categories. Are you a lead or a supporting person in a musical or a play? However, revival and new show is an area where you almost never have any wiggle room. It's just an unusual situation that Shuffle Along has wiggle room, and validly so. You know, it is based on a show that existed, and a lot of the first act recreates numbers from that show. So there was an argument to be made. Rarely does any show have that argument because they're either new or they're revivals. In this case, it was sort of an odd duck, and why not take advantage and try and make yourself in a category where you're not going to get stomped by Hamilton?
And what I like to kind of think of it in terms of, you know, Hollywood is always, or I should say Broadway, is always turning to Hollywood for their new productions, right? I mean, you have Waitress. Okay, that was a movie first. You have, what was the one? Kinky Boots. Okay, that was a movie first. And now they're doing the same thing with awards because The Martian this year at the Golden Globes won Best Comedy. So, you know, they're like trying to, their little award show maneuverings are coming right straight out of Hollywood too.
Well, this article, which is a fine article, and yes, Hamilton's a big show. So, of course, it's got a ripple effect on everybody around it. But it's only good news. And they say, oh, best musical locks are rare. And they mention A Chorus Line in 1975 and The Producers in 2001. To which I would add The Book of Mormon in 2011, In the Heights in 2008, Jersey Boys in 2006, Hairspray in 2003, The Lion King, Rent, Sunset Boulevard, Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis. You look at those years, and I'm not just retrospectively saying, oh, you know, it's now obvious who should win. It was obvious at the time. Wicked actually didn't win, and it wasn't a year where it was a very competitive category, and it wasn't clear. They were a big monster hit, but they had a lot of mixed reviews. That's why they weren't a lock. But all these shows I'm mentioning had rave reviews. Sunset Boulevard opened in a year where there were only two shows. There was no question it was going to win. It was the nadir of Broadway for new musicals. But, you know, it's no. Best musical locks are a lot more common than that. There's a lot more years where they are competitive. But just like, unlike Hollywood, I'd say, or even the Grammys, when a show's a big hit and gets good reviews, it almost always wins the Tony for Best Musical.
Well, I would imagine one show that is not going to win Best Musical or even be nominated this year for it is a show I think you saw last week, which is American Psycho. Yes, another movie based on a book by Bret Easton Ellis. But you saw this musical and it did not get very good reviews.
It got mixed reviews. It could certainly be up for key awards and it could be up for Best Musical. I doubt it, but it's not a given that it won't be. I'm sure it has passionate fans. It's Duncan Sheik who did Spring Awakening.
Oh, okay.
There's four or five nominations. Slots available for Best New Musical. The two ones that are clearly in are Shuffle Along and Hamilton, and Hamilton will win. Beyond that, I don't think it's clear. School of Rock, Waitress, American Psycho, they've all got their fans. So I wouldn't rule it out. The only other thing I would take exception to in this article is where they say revivals play second banana. I don't know about that. I mean, revivals are where the action is a lot of time. And again, you look at the winners over the past 20 years. You know, like 1997, Titanic won Best Musical. Who cares? Chicago won Best Revival, and that's still running. And that was a monster hit at the time. In the Heights won Best Musical. South Pacific won Best Revival. That may have been a bigger hit. You know, so revivals are actually kind of where a lot of the heat is.
Well, and what I would point out this year especially, the Tony's, the telecast, okay, is going to probably have some significant ratings, okay? A little bit of a bump. And for all of these shows that are being, shown on
like as always, what matters more than the award for Best Musical for anything but Best Musical is getting the chance to perform on the show in front of an audience,
right? Because then when those shows tour, and they do tour not only across the United States but across the world, people will, it builds awareness for that.
Yeah, and people were hugely excited to see Hamilton performed on the Grammy Awards, and they did a brilliant job preparing for that production. I don't know what song they're going to do for the Tonys. Maybe they'll recreate that one.
Yeah, I don't
because
know.
Because they put a lot of effort into it. Maybe they'll do another number. But the fact is, the Tonys have not been a big rating success pretty much ever.
Yeah.
But certainly not in many years. They reach a small, select, wealthy, smarter audience that goes to the theater. And that's the audience they're going to reach this year. If there's a slight uptick, it will certainly be due to Hamilton and the fact that most people won't see it on Broadway and are excited to see those actors perform the music they've been listening to. And that means people in Waitress and people in The Color Purple and people in all these other shows like Shuffle Along, they're going to have a chance to strut their stuff and win some fans. And a big hit is good for everybody. The idea that this is a problem is nuts.
So whether you win the award or not, if you're a big hit, it's a big deal.
Absolutely.
Then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the team behind Top Gear, in some ways the most popular show in the world in recent years, was fired or they quit in solidarity, depending on your point of view. We do know one thing. They're going to launch a car-focused show for Amazon. And now, we know they're not stopping there. Jeremy Clarkson and others who had turned Top Gear into a massive phenomenon are partnering on a digital platform called Drive Tribe that will deal with all things car-related. It will feature different quote-unquote tribes for different types of car enthusiasts, vertical integration because everyone loves to talk about verticals, and lots of fan-created content because, of course, everyone loves to get fans developing content for free. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal in a way. They're rethinking the whole brand and what they're going to do with it. I mean, it's a new brand. Of course, it's a new show. But when you think about it, there are people who love NASCAR. There are people who love Formula One. There are people who love just tinkering with their car in their garage or off-roading. There's lots of different types of car enthusiasts. And as they say, there's no really big platform online, and they think they can be the voice for that. That may end up being as powerful or more profitable than the show itself.
Well, that brings us to the filming of Maze Runner 3, which was delayed after star Dylan O'Brien was hit by a car in an on-set accident. Okay, those words put together in a sentence usually are never good, especially if you're a studio executive. But now the production has been delayed indefinitely because O'Brien's recovery will take longer than expected. O'Brien was in a harness, by the way, on top of a car when the stunt went awry. The film is set to be released in February of 2017, though naturally that may change as well. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's obviously a big deal for Dylan O'Brien. That's your first thought is, good God, you hope the guy gets okay and recovers fully. It is shocking to me somehow that this doesn't happen more often.
Well, yeah, I agree.
You know, there's so many movies and so many people, illness, death, onset accidents, just something that happens in their home, you know, they break a leg. It's kind of unusual how rare it is. You know, Harrison Ford breaks his leg or whatever happened to him on the set of Star Wars. And that's, you know, wow, everybody knows about it. This, you know, it's a tragedy what happened to him. It presumably was preventable and shouldn't have happened and all that sort of stuff. I don't know what the details are, but you know, there's so many dangerous things going on in a film where just the fact that someone could get sick and it just doesn't happen that much, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, you kind of have to thank the safety precautions that are taken. I also think green screen
just
helps.
Even like someone gets measles, you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
saying
yeah.
It's not to, or it gets a heart attack because whatever, you know, but it really, you don't hear about it that much. People dying unexpectedly in the making of a film. I mean, there's so many movies and TV shows filming all the time that it's kind of a surprise. It doesn't happen more often. In this case, I'm sure there will be an investigation, or there already is, as far as what happened and why. But, you know, it's thank God this thing doesn't happen more often, and hopefully O'Brien will get better.
Hey, Michael, when you cut the cord, make sure to add one more streaming service to the list of outlets you've got to have.
Ugh.
It's called Filmstruck, and it's a partnership between Turner Classic Movies and the Criterion Collection label. The site will include hundreds of movies at a time, some of them coming from the vaults of TCM and others coming from a rotating selection curated by Criterion. It will also include bonus content for movies, presumably the sort already generated by TCM for its channel and by Criterion for its famed Blu-ray releases. They don't have a price point or launch date, but you can assume the fall of 2016 and, roughly $10. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to say big deal. This
what?
Is interesting in like seven ways. First
oh
of all,
gosh. I thought for sure you'd be like, next.
No, you know, first of all, it's like, it's just a couple hundred movies. And my thought was, really, you're trying to launch a service where you just have like hundreds of movies available at a time. But because it's Criterion and Turner Classic Movies, there are probably hundreds of movies, all of which people who subscribe to this will care about.
That's right.
You know, it's not, and when I've got a library of Criterion films on DVD and Blu-ray, and I have not watched all of them. Certainly not even having received them. I've seen A Hard Day's Night. Have I watched my Criterion version? Not necessarily. But I could just work my way through them and be very happy. watch one every two or three days, and it would take me a year or two. So I thought, oh boy, what a small selection. But in fact, when it's curated and they're actually all really of interest to you, and it brings your attention to something you wouldn't have followed otherwise, maybe you weren't ready to watch the Apu trilogy, but because it's there and because you subscribe, maybe you'll take a chance on it. And you're dealing with all high quality stuff. It's not like most of these sites where you've got maybe 1,000 stuff, but it's a lot of junk.
Yeah, I actually watched Lady Hawk over the weekend, and I could not believe that Amazon, now it's streaming on Amazon, it's not their fault, they're streaming what they've been given. But the quality was atrocious.
Oh, this is the Matthew Broderick film?
Yes.
Yeah, it's as I recall, I kind of liked it. I don't know how much it holds up, but it was probably a little modern jokey in my mind, I'm remembering. But
yes, it's definitely a 1980s movie. That's for
sure. Yeah. But this is it. That's interesting. However, it's like one more service you need to add to your pile if you want to do it. I mean, what I really want is to buy Turner Classic Movies as an app without having to subscribe to cable. That's what I want. I love Criterion, don't get me wrong. Right. But what I want is to be able to pay $8 and just get access to what they're showing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Right. That would be even more valuable.
That would indeed.
However, I'm also finding it interesting because the Criterion Collection in this sort of rotating library was on Hulu Plus for a while. Like knowing where to go to find Criterion movies is really hard. It's again, it's all part of this whole search thing. You know, you can't just turn on your TV and find stuff. You've got to figure out what service offers what and subscribe to them. That gets very, very hard. So that's interesting.
I'm telling you, you've got a business model there, Michael.
I know. It's very, very tricky.
Speaking of tricky, The Hollywood Reporter wrote a story about a backlash against the Cannes Film Festival over a quote-unquote chilling. That's the adjective used to describe this video that had been posted online. It looked like an attack on the Palais des Festivals there in Cannes was being foiled by police. But in fact, it was a video of a training practice in which police and security performed a mock exercise about what to do in the face of multiple terrorist events occurring at once. The Hollywood Reporter led with a quote from an industry veteran about the backlash saying, quote, "I only found out we might be in danger when I saw the video," end quote. I know the answer already, Michael, but is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. We're very hard. I'm very hard on the Hollywood Reporter sometimes because we read them every day and we get their emails every day and we care because they're covering stuff we pay attention to. And so this was just like they wanted to put the video up, right?
Right, which is fine.
They acted like it was a total non. They could have just said, hey, look, they're working on security at the Palais. Instead, they had to create a fake controversy. In fact, the story said, well, nobody's canceled their trip there. And nobody really cares. And why would anyone care anyway? Do they not want them to practice for terrorist attacks? You know, what is the, oh my God, I wasn't going to go to the Keys, but now I find out that they prepare in case of hurricanes and really doesn't make me want to go.
Well, ever since 9/11 in the U.S., they have searched people going in and out of the Palais, no matter which entrance you go in.
But they have security.
Right. And
tighter security than they did before.
Right. And it gets a little lax toward the end of the 2 weeks. And yes, there has been conversations in years past about, gee, this is kind of a soft target. You know, you got all these celebrities there and there's
so is everything in the world.
Exactly. Now, what? I'm agreeing with you, by the way, about all of this. Do I think, hey, you know, gee, you know, because of this, the publicity surrounding this drill, now terrorists might think, oh, well, you know what? That is a good idea. We should go there. You know what? One of the terrorists from the Paris attacks back in November was actually arrested, I believe, in Cannes. So somebody associated with that was arrested in Cannes earlier in the year. So
forgive me. What idiot never thought, gee, Cannes could be of course it's could be. So could every convention you attend. So could the Eiffel Tower. So could every McDonald's you've ever been inside. Of course Cannes could be like you thought, wow, I never thought it could be a terrorist problem until I saw the video. Well, you're an idiot then. You're just a dumb person. And this video is what they should be doing. And to act like there's a backlash when they couldn't find a single person to say, I'm outraged that they're practicing for security. Because that person would look like a moron. There's no backlash. There's nothing chilling about it. It's what they should be doing. And if you wanted to show the video, fine. But pretending there's a controversy when there's none and could be none unless you find the dumbest person in the world is kind of annoying.
Well, and especially after the Paris attacks, you know, there was a lot of there was a backlash there saying, hey, the Paris police weren't prepared. Well, okay, now they are.
Yeah, now they're preparing and you're angry at them.
Right.
Oh my God, they're preparing. It's stupid on every level.
The BBC says it reaches some 350 million people worldwide each week with its news coverage. That's almost 5% of the entire global population accessing BBC news content via TV, radio, the internet, and other platforms. CNN may reach a bigger global TV audience, not to mention a very vibrant digital platform, but the BBC has a huge lead in radio. And of course, this doesn't include the audience it reaches with original TV shows like Doctor Who. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal to show what kind of a great brand it is when you're talking about defending the budget for the BBC. What does that add to the culture? What does that add to the power of the UK as far as in terms of world opinion and influencing people by being that trusted source? I think that's really underappreciated in that country. I wonder how many people CNN reaches. I couldn't find out any good numbers, nor do I really know how they came up with this number, 350 million. But it probably doesn't take a lot to get there when you think about BBC Worldwide and their radio service and their incredibly good website. So I'm not surprised to hear they would reach that many people.
Now, the China crackdown on foreign companies with online content is getting serious. Apple had two key services, movies and books, shut down just 6 months after they opened for business in the country. Now Disney has seen their website, Disney Life, shut down just 5 months after launching. The nominal reason is new rules governing foreign content ownership. The Disney Life site was launched in partnership with Alibaba. The shutdown takes place just 2 months before the opening of the new theme park, Disney Shanghai Resort. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal, right?
Yeah, well, especially because there seems to be some confusion as to why this is going on. It's not so straightforward. It's, well, is
well,
it foreign
is
ownership?
Or, China.
Yeah.
So what's the confusion? We think it's either an internal power struggle to see who's in charge, or is it China in general saying, we're in charge of our country, not foreigners. We want to control what people watch and see and do.
Well, you've just done a wonderful job of highlighting both the issues. So, yes.
So that's what we're, it's obviously a balance between the two. What's dominating here, do you think? I think it's probably more just the government itself saying, we're letting this free market get a little ahead of itself.
Correct. I think that's probably true. I think there is some concern about foreign ownership. But you know what? Here's the thing. You can't ask these multinational organizations and companies to come in and spend a whole lot of money on things if you're then going to, you know, rip the rug out from under them just 4, 5, or 6 months later.
Well, this is where the problem is for companies. It's also a problem for China because they're doing this at a time when their economy is slowing down.
That's right.
And they've had explosive growth. So they're really, they need probably more foreign investment more than they need to control the content right now. And they're making the mistake of panicking when the economy slows down, of clamping down on foreigners. That's going to slow down investment pretty hard. I mean, your market's big, but you can't get people wasting hundreds of millions of dollars on launching stuff and then just take it away from them without getting big long-term payback. People are going to start thinking twice. Look what happened with Carl Icahn. I mean, I think it's just sort of a stunt, but he sold off all his Apple stock because he said, you know what? I'm a little worried about China. Their economy is slowing down. You can't trust the government to let you do business. It's not a great market, as if that's all Apple's play is China. And if China doesn't do great, Apple has no company. I don't really agree with that. I think he just wanted to sell his stock because he bought it. And now it's higher and he can make money.
Yeah, but anyway. they made umpteen billions of dollars less than they did at the same quarter a year. I mean, okay, they're very profitable.
Right. The idea that they're not, you know, huge, they're not going to grow by 30 or 40% a year for the rest of their lives is what these people are reacting to. Ah, it's a disaster.
The daytime Emmys announced their winners. The top prize went to General Hospital for Best Drama. Though with so few soaps left on the air, is that really the top prize anymore? The real drama was elsewhere. CBS Sunday Morning won Best Morning Program for the second time, beating the 800-pound gorillas. There are those gorillas
there
again.
There they are again. My God.
The Today Show and Good Morning America are those 800-pound gorillas. Now there's more than one. There's two of them. The Talk blasted past its rival, The View, to win Best Talk Show. And the now strained duo, Kelly Ripa and Michael Strahan, won Best Host for their once-friendly Gab Fest. Showbiz Sandbox favorite Craig Ferguson won't be returning to Late Night anytime soon. He won his second Emmy in a row for Best Game Show Host. Big deal or big whoop?
This must have been more fun than any of the shows airing in morning television.
That's true.
That's a lot of drama going on here. I'm sorry I didn't watch. And there is a lot of drama going on in daytime. Kelly Ripa and Michael Strahan, that's hilarious that they would win this year. And by the way, Live is worth about $80 to $90 million a year to Disney. Wow. That's the franchise. You know, they want to move another hour of GMA there maybe. Well, guess what? You're already making $90 million in that hour. Is that really something you want to mess with? But, you know, there's a lot of action everywhere. Billy Bush, it was announced this week, is leaving Access Hollywood Live, and he's going to anchor the 9 a.m. hour of the Today Show. The Today Show, by the way, runs 4 hours from 7 a.m. to 11. Good Morning America only runs 2. And they're like, can we have another hour, please?
Yeah, we want to be like them.
Exactly.
Speaking of being like them, Hulu is yet another company that would love to sign consumers up for an over-the-top service that would mimic basic cable. It's shooting for an early 2017 launch, but keep in mind that they haven't even signed deals with their owners. Of course, their owners include people behind, you know, ABC, NBC, and Fox. So only CBS would keep them from being able to provide a full service package that would at least offer the major networks.
And CBS will do that.
Oh yeah, no, they will. Yeah. They will absolutely not sign up for this.
No interest. No, thank you.
Yeah, they, I mean, look, they could have signed up eons ago to Hulu, but they didn't. Hulu wants to give people the chance to buy a basic cable package for about $40, with, of course, those networks that we just mentioned, CW, sports channels, and the Hulu originals. Will it happen? How much will your internet provider charge you once you dump your $120 cable package and start massively increasing the amount of video you stream? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop until they sign some deals and announce what channels will be on there and how much it costs. You know, say, hey, we're working on this. Thank you very much. You know, and cord cutting? Not yet. I mean, we've got surveys and things, and we feel like there's a trend, but the facts are that the leading U.S. pay TV firms have maintained their subscriber numbers. The latest report of what the actual numbers are, they gained viewers in the first quarter of 2016. That's where we're at. Four of the six gained, I think, ATT, I think, was the one that lost, but another one made it up, you know. So basically, they've got the same people that they've always had. So cord cutting is there. It's in the future. It won't lower your bill, and it will happen in some way, shape, or form, but it's not happening yet.
So which number do you want to focus on, Michael? The reboot of Ghostbusters has been a little polarizing, with some appreciating the update and others wondering why they even bothered. Some are glad to see women top line the new version, while others are embarrassed that the lone black character of note seems the least educated and most cliched, since black people being hilariously afraid of ghosts is a Hollywood stereotype since before sound. I'm just learning that myself. Wow, didn't know that was a stereotype. The proof is in the numbers. The Ghostbuster trailer has been viewed more than 29 million times on YouTube.
Yay!
It's been disliked twice as often as it's been liked.
Ooh.
In fact, it's one of the most disliked videos in YouTube history.
Whoopsie.
But forget YouTube. The hot new platform is Facebook, and 32,000 people were negative there about the Melissa McCarthy comedy.
Ooh.
But almost 1.2 million people were positive.
Yay!
So is all this a big deal or a big whoop? We really have been talking
too long. This is the worst post ever, right? Yeah, this is it's a big whoop, right? And you want people to see your trailer. I mean, clearly you want people to see your trailer and go, I can't wait to see that. That's hilarious. I bet all the best jokes are there because it's so funny. When they watch it and go, it's not such a great thing. But people are interested. They want to know it. They're watching the video. If the movie's actually good, though, why the trailer shouldn't be at least a little entertaining if the movie is, I don't know. But, you know, the disaster will happen when we actually see the movie.
Well,
it's certainly not a great sign.
No, and they showed clips of it at CinemaCon, and I think it underwhelmed. I definitely think it was, again, why are they doing this? You know, it just didn't...
People wanted a new Ghostbusters movie for a year. Do it again with women. Why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Studios care if people dislike a trailer? Obviously, the whole point is to promote the movie.
Yes, I think they do, to the point where I think, actually, Fox is pulling out of Comic-Con. They say it's over piracy fears, but I kind of wonder, it's like, really, you're afraid people are going to pirate your exclusive...
Your trailer to promote your movie and get people to watch. The thing that you want people to watch, you're afraid they'll watch.
Correct, yeah. So, you know, you don't want people to see your commercial? I'm confused.
Right, so what's happening here?
So, Fox is a studio, obviously, but they go to Comic-Con every year. along with many of the studios, and it cost them a fortune. Last year, they brought Deadpool and X-Men Apocalypse and a whole bunch of other movies. This year, they could have brought, you know, Wolverine, and it's a place, it's a nerd fest for all of the big comic book fans and big action fans.
And it's a massive, massive platform in which to reach a worldwide media audience.
Right. There's a lot of buzz coming out of Comic-Con. And yeah. And even afterwards, when movies are released, you'll hear, oh, it was a big hit at Comic-Con.
Right. So, and this year, they're not going. And why not?
Well, they say that they have some fears over some of the clips, exclusive clips, and the trailers that they screen in Hall H. This is that big 6,000-seat arena where mm-hmm. they screen some of these movies for fans, that it's going to be pirated. And this did happen, actually, last year. You know, there was a...
Right. They showed a trailer with exclusive footage that wouldn't be in another trailer for Deadpool, right?
Right. And then it showed up 2 days later on the internet.
But it is a trailer.
That's my understanding.
They didn't show the movie and have the movie leak online.
That
they didn't have 10 minutes and have 10 minutes leak online. They showed a trailer with special footage cut just for the Comic-Con fans. But nonetheless, they had to think this might get out, right?
Right. Well, and you'd hope that, you know, people going to Comic-Con wouldn't be that way, but
right,
they are.
So Comic-Con, they're not showing up because they don't want people to pirate the trailers that they're showing, to which you say...
Well, I say,
why not just release the trailer the day after you show it at Comic-Con exclusive? They get to see it first, yeah. So then the next day it's on the line for everyone in the world to see.
Yes, that is what I say. And plus, they get all the free publicity when someone pirates the trailer. It's a promotional tool. Not to say that people should be pirating trailers. I'm not saying that. I'm saying...
Of course not.
They're pirating a commercial.
The point is, they would have shown glimpses of Assassin's Creed, Wolverine 3, and they thought maybe the next Maze Runner movie. Well, the Michael Fassbender film Assassin's Creed looks a little iffy, frankly. Wolverine 3 wasn't any, you know, 2 and 1 were not that well received critically. And Maze Runner has just been delayed by this terrible on-set accident with its star Dylan O'Brien. So maybe they just said, we don't have a lot of great stuff to show. One of our three movies has just dropped out. We're going to have to delay that. And we don't have footage that we're really psyched, and we don't want to go to Comic-Con and have people go, oh, I'm not excited anymore.
Especially when you have to pay a fortune for it.
Was it really a fortune?
Oh, yeah. They pay a hefty penny. And there's always been talk.
Eight figures?
No.
Well, then that's not a fortune.
It's millions.
It's one ad on TV.
Well, okay, sure. But on the right show, of course. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a way
it's a promotional
to kind of...
platform. And if you don't have stuff to promote that you're excited by, and you think if we let the fans see it early and they might turn on it, I mean, is this too cynical? It just doesn't make any sense that they would be upset about a trailer leaking.
Yeah, well, you know, look,
you want to control it, but still.
That's their story. They're sticking to it. And Disney is actually supposedly thinking of maybe pulling out.
Because a trailer might leak?
I think really it's getting to the point where they're like, you know what, how much value are we really getting?
Well, they do their own convention.
Right.
Right. They do their own huge Comic-Con type convention, hugely attended by their fans, where they can control everything and they don't have to come into someone else's space. So that's a different issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that when you can control the message, and this is, by the way, the same thing that's happening. It used to be that people would go to CES if you were a consumer electronics company. Now right. You've got Apple and Microsoft and Samsung. They're pulling out of these shows and saying, you know what? We'll invite all the press to our own little gatherings and be the belle of the ball at our own show.
Well, that's most studios can't do that, though.
I agree. Yes.
They don't have enough to draw in. I mean, Disney's a little unusual because of their theme parks and all the things they have going on. Fox cannot do that.
No, that is true.
They can't have their own convention.
No,
aren't going to go to eight conventions.
That is true. Lionsgate's not going to be able to do it. Paramount can't do it. So, yeah.
But if Comcast had a convention, they could certainly start to talk about DreamWorks Animation, couldn't they?
They could. In fact, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're talking about DreamWorks Animation. We've talked about them a lot over the past few years and how we felt that they, DreamWorks Animation, were in better shape than a lot of people were giving them credit for. Apparently, Comcast agreed with us because they are paying $3.8 billion to acquire the animation studio. Here to talk about the deal and what it means not only for Comcast, but the industry at large, is Meg James, a corporate media reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us, Meg.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
So were you surprised by the deal? We know that DreamWorks Animation has been looking to find a home for quite a while, and people have kicked the tires. This did seem to still come out a little bit out of nowhere, I guess.
It did. I think that's a very good point. It sort of like exploded last week. There was originally a report that Comcast was in talks for DreamWorks. And at first people were saying, this doesn't make any sense. But the more you looked at the deal, the more it made a ton of sense, particularly for Comcast, because DreamWorks Animation has such a vibrant studio. And that was one area that Comcast was trying to build up through Illumination Entertainment, but still, you know, was a ways away from being established.
Well, and Illumination Entertainment, we should point out, is kind of Universal's in-house animation company, and they're responsible for Despicable Me. And, you know, it seems that Comcast has wanted to be in the animation business for some time, or at least in the Disney business, because they tried to buy Disney, I think, back in the aughts.
Yes, a very good point. And it's twofold. Comcast has long seen owning content is the best way forward, although they're uniquely positioned among the media companies because they also have a very robust business of providing high-speed internet and cable television programming to more than 22 million customers. But Brian Roberts, who is the head of Comcast, and Steve Burke, his lieutenant, have long sort of had their eye on building sort of a Disney. And you're right. In 2004, they went after Disney. It was a hostile bid. Disney was able to rebuff their advances. And 5 years later, Comcast started talking to General Electric, which at the time was very eager to unload its entertainment properties. And so Comcast came in and bought NBC Universal for really a bargain price. In fact, they even used profits from the company to finance their purchase. And that was just a testament to Comcast deal making, their timing, and General Electric's interest in getting out.
And are they doing the same thing here? Because DreamWorks Animation, we've always thought they've got some good things going on in TV. They've got valuable properties. People run them down as if they're this disastrous nightmare of a company just because like one movie does poorly. And we're like, that's not how the business works. And we felt like there was a lot of value there with the right owner. And Comcast has come in and said, yep, maybe we're that owner.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. I mean, the problem that DreamWorks Animation has had is that they're a publicly traded company, so they have to perform for Wall Street. And when a single individual film doesn't meet expectations, then it can have disastrous, you know, consequences on Wall Street, because then the investors are like, what are we in this stock for? And then they bail, and then the stock goes down. And it's too volatile of a business to have such a pure play as in just a studio. And that's why, you know, Comcast, Viacom, Disney, Fox, and others have more diversified businesses, and they can ride out sort of the ebbs and flows of the movie industry. And Comcast has, to your point, they've been looking to build up their animation business. Illumination has just been a gigantic home run for them. But Illumination, you know, is turning out one film a year. And so here, you know, DreamWorks comes along and Comcast can expand from two animated films a year to four. And in this environment, when family entertainment is trading at such a premium, it really makes a lot of sense for Comcast.
Well, and, you know, I think laying off 500 workers a year or so ago, I think it was last year they laid off 500 workers at DreamWorks Animation. That probably didn't help the cause in pitching that their company was healthy.
No, and in fact, that's absolutely the point, and it probably didn't help them attract investors, although what we have heard in pretty reliable sources was that DreamWorks was in talks with a Chinese investor to take the company private, and therefore they wouldn't be so much on the hooks with what Wall Street thought. And that's when Comcast got wind that DreamWorks was talking to this investor. We don't know who the investor was. And so Brian Roberts, the head of Comcast, called Jeffrey Katzenberg at DreamWorks and said, hey, you know, we want to talk. And that began a whirlwind, you know, 2 week courtship, which culminated in the $3.8 billion deal last week.
Well, I hope they sent a gift basket to this anonymous Chinese investor. Because, I mean, let's be honest, we're in talks with private Chinese investors. You're probably in talks with private Chinese investors. I mean, who isn't, right?
Well, actually, I'm not, but who knows? That's a very good point.
Well, let me just say the Comcast deal for DreamWorks Animation, they're modeling themselves perhaps openly on Disney. Disney bought, you know, Lucasfilms and Pixar and Marvel. And Marvel may have been just as smart a buy as far as the timing. They bought Marvel Studios in 2009. They had just released Iron Man, but that was followed by the flop, The Incredible Hulk. So it was before the huge run of success stories. It certainly was a good beginning, but they bought Marvel had been in a lot of disarray leading up to Iron Man, and their follow-up movie wasn't a huge hit. So it was a great time to buy them, right? Buy them when they look a little troubled and help build them up into something really big.
Yes, absolutely. And Disney and Bob Iger at Disney have really built the company in large part on these very smart strategic acquisitions. And, you know, Disney bought Pixar, they bought Marvel, and most recently they bought Lucasfilms. And all of those bets, even though they paid, you know, multi-billion dollars, you know, $5-6 billion for each of these individual properties, they're all paying off for Disney because, you know, you saw what happened with the latest Star Wars release. I mean, it is huge, over $1 billion around the world. And also this very familiar IP, intellectual property, plays well overseas because people are familiar with the concepts. And you're right. It's no secret that Comcast is really modeling themselves after Disney, what Bob Iger said with Disney, because it takes several years to build a studio up. You know, we've seen, you know, they've been working with Illumination for 5 years now. And by just swooping in and buying an existing studio and brands and all the brands, it will be hugely beneficial, I think, for Comcast, because just look at the characters that they can use in their theme parks, from the Kung Fu Pandas to Shrek to Madagascar. I mean, and Comcast, NBC Universal has really been building up their theme park business over the last few years.
Well, and that brings us to Jeffrey Katzenberg. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, he was trying to take the company private with a Chinese investor. He had actually been trying to, as some people say, unload the company to SoftBank and other investors in previous years, and that was unsuccessful. But he was trying to do it in a way where he would remain in control. I was actually at Universal Studios or Universal Pictures when this news broke about Comcast purchasing DreamWorks. It was interesting to see the reaction from the executives who were learning it in real time. And they said, well, look, you know, Chris Meledandri is not going to report to Jeffrey Katzenberg. And so Katzenberg is effectively going to take a chairman role now and let Chris Meledandri take over the company he built over 22 years.
So he'll have to take his $400 million and just go home.
Yes.
Right. But I mean, that was the issue in the past, because several different Hollywood studios have looked at DreamWorks Animation, and all of them sort of came away thinking it was a great product, but Jeffrey still wanted to be in charge. And if you're a Comcast, you know, you really respect everything that Jeffrey's done, but you want to run it your way, and you don't want to have some of the issues that, you know, so often exist when you bring in a very strong and powerful manager. You know, he's used to running it one way, and Comcast saw that they, you know, they wanted to run it the way that they wanted to run it, and they were spending the $3.8 billion. And that's, I think, a large part of why it's such a premium over what the DreamWorks stock had been trading for. I mean, they paid, you know, 50% higher than what the stock was trading for. And that was in large part to say, you know, hey, you know, Jeffrey, we recognize all that you've done. You've been, you know, you've built this company. No one else has built it the way you have. But we're gonna, you know, we're gonna take the keys now. And here's the $3.8 billion, and your $400 million, or whatever the payoff turns out to be.
And please go away. And,
yes.
And now,
well,
and now he's, and
it
now
is
he's
interesting that Jeffrey is going to stay on to manage the Awesomeness TV and Nova, the digital properties, but he is not. He's going to be serving as a consultant, but he doesn't have a chairman title.
I thought he did.
That there will be a lot of expertise that Jeffrey will be providing to Comcast, but day-to-day management won't be one.
That's until Disney acquires him to replace Bob Iger when he steps down to retire.
That could happen. You never know. And Hollywood, you never know.
Well, who knows? Maybe we just, you know, we're predicting it now. Something else I predict is at some point, Comcast kind of is vertically integrated. They're manufacturing and they're distributing the product they manufacture. And I'm waiting for, I don't think it's going to be a Paramount decree like in the 1948 Supreme Court ruling, but I do wonder at what point that gets looked at.
Well, you know, that's a great, great point. And a lot of people miss that, but that was the reason why Comcast was unsuccessful in buying Time Warner Cable, was that the Justice Department and the FCC looked at that and thought, whoa, that's way too much control in one company. They have, you know, all this content-making abilities. They have theme parks. They have TV networks. And with the Comcast Time Warner Cable deal, that would have made them, you know, the primary high-speed internet delivery service in most of the major markets, and the government looked at that and said, you know, this isn't going to work. And so that's why that deal fell apart. And it also shows how, when, back to your original thing, when Comcast kind of swooped in and bought NBC Universal, it was 2009, 2010. The deal was actually approved in January 2011. And the environment was so much different than it is now. And companies, you know, were on less solid financial footing than they are now. So that really shows the change that we've seen in the last 5 years, as the government really is sort of starting to look at this and say, that's a lot of power in one company.
Well, certainly, it's billion-dollar deals like this don't come along every week. So we appreciate your being here to help us unravel it and explain what happened with Comcast purchasing DreamWorks Animation. Meg James, your work can be found at the Los Angeles Times, and we'll place links to it in our show notes. And we appreciate you being here to explain it.
All right. Thanks so very much. You guys do a great job, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was good of Meg to join us. It's good news for almost everyone except the employees of DreamWorks Animation.
I know, yeah, because you know that what's going to wind up happening. Illumination Entertainment, they have their own their own animation department. You know, they have their own company, and there will be a lot of
overlap.
Redundancies, yes.
And they've already, of course, laid off a lot of people and moved stuff to China and moved stuff overseas. So, you know. But if talk about people that affecting, it's them.
Well, you mean DreamWorks Animation done that. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, certainly Illumination does their animation overseas as well. Chris Meledandri, who heads that company up and who founded it, has been credited with basically taking this animation model and saying, I know you guys are spending about $150 to $175 million.
Let's spend 90.
Yeah. Let's spend like 70, 80, 90. And it's worked. It actually has worked. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether he ups the budgets with DreamWorks Animation or he takes a page out of his own playbook.
And you talked about vertical integration and, frankly, antitrust, how much power they have. Maybe eyeing that, Comcast said, hey, maybe we should do something nice for a change.
You got that out of that really poorly executed and asked question? That's good. Yeah. Certainly one of our listeners, Sarah P., sent us an email with a link that says Comcast ups data usage caps to 1 terabyte and Netflix's CEO applauds. This was because, Michael, you were mentioning it on last week's show.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more data capping going on. There's a lot more slowing down of internet speed for people who pay their monthly fee. You know, more and more people want to stream video, and that means more and more they're smashing through these data caps and finding suddenly their internet service is crawling for the last 2 weeks of the month.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of an interesting, I mean, for those of you who don't know the Paramount decree, I'm not going to get into it now, Wikipedia it, Google it, you'll see that vertical integration in motion picture studios was not necessarily appreciated in the 40s.
Right, they used to own the studios, own the theaters, they owned everything from soup to nuts. And
right.
That was decided was too much vertical, they owned everything. And so you can't do that. If you want, you know, you got to have certain people, you know, there's got to be competition. There's got to be more people not controlling everything from beginning to end. And that's even more important when you talk about, you know, the home and your access to information.
Correct. And, you know, in the 40s, it was, hey, we can't book movies from, you know, a competing studio because they put it in their own theaters. And of course, they, you know, studios don't own movie theaters anymore. Here, I don't think that that's an issue yet. We'll see what happens coming down the road. I mean, that's what all of these, you know, retransmission agreement fights are about in part.
Right. And it's just a changing world. And Comcast said, hey, we've got to up our data cap because everybody's blowing through the data cap we have right now. And they're going to start to get really angry with us. So they said, all right, we'll increase it from 300 megabytes or whatever it is to 1 terabyte a month.
Right, and Netflix CEO said, now I can stream all day long. Reed Hastings, of course, doesn't live in the areas where there are data caps, but still, he was very happy. And, of course, Sarah P. wrote to Dirt at showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store. We're now on the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. We can be found, and we do appreciate it when you subscribe and you rate and review the shows. All of that information can be found on showbizsandbox.com, our website, and that's where you can find all those ways to contact us and follow us. At Showbiz Sandbox is our Twitter handle, or Like us on Facebook, where just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Once again, I'd like to thank Meg James from the Los Angeles Times for joining us. I'd also like to thank MGMT. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by that popular rock group. They can be found on their own website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Cordcuttingisamyth.com.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work on that particular website, which I don't even know if it exists, but
well, privacy is a myth. You know that's true.
Privacy is okay, fine. Privacy is a myth. Just ask Edward Snowden. You can, I don't know, head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of his coverage of the entertainment industry, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, he also runs bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.